Good morning. So last time we talked about finishing up our pipeline processor and talked about how we implement our PC update. It was mentioned in the book's technique is that they said, okay, well, we don't really know what the next PC is, so our PC is really a predictive PC. And their design was that they would have our predictive PC using either PC plus an increment or the target of a jump that we're predicting. And they correct that prediction for the cases of conditional jumps that we mispredicted or returns at the beginning of fetch just before we sent the address to the instruction memory. And I mentioned that, well, when we need to do stalling with this, we need to be a little careful that we want to take into account the corrected PC when we're deciding to repeat. So we have to say stall because we have a value that needs to go from memory to execute, then the way we're going to do that is by repeating whatever PC we had after any corrections. So like if we return to something that needs a correction, we'll fix using that. Then we started talking about caches. So when we're talking about sort of our pipeline processor, we made this assumption about how the memory worked, which said, oh, the memories are just something which takes one cycle, and that's just how they work. So we put in a value, we got the result out in the same cycle. For writing, we put in a value and put an address, I should say, not a value, put an address and for writing a value, and that gets stored at the end of the cycle. And we learned at the beginning of the semester that this wasn't how things really were. And we're trying to kind of talk about how do processors bridge that gap. And the solution we use in practice is we have some fast, small memories that really could act in that way where they take one cycle to do things. And we have slow, larger ones. And the problem is that, well, we want to have the speed something like those small memories, but we want to have capacity something like those large memories. And we want programs, you know, to have the impression that everything is as fast as that small memory, at least as close as possible to that. And it seems like that this is not really possible intuitively because, well, you know, if we can't make something big that's fast, how could it be the case that our programs can use a lot of memory and be fast? And it turns out that there's some convenient properties of how programs are actually written which makes this possible, and those were locality. And we had two types of locality we cared about. So one was temporal locality, that when we see something accessed, it's likely to be accessed again. So this means that when we're designing caches, we can keep things that the program accessed recently, and that is likely to be something that the program accesses again. And therefore, the next times the program accesses that, we will have fast accesses. The program won't see that we have this slow, big memory. We also have spatial locality, that if we keep things nearby what the program accessed, that those are likely to be accessed soon. So we can take advantage of that by storing just more than just what the program asked for, and again, make it so the program's accesses usually use these fast memories and not these slow ones, even though it's accessing a total amount of data that doesn't fit in the fast memory. Okay, so questions about these, our PC update logic, or the general idea of sort of this cache hierarchy using these small memories to store things, hopefully most of the time, but having these large memories where we can have the capacity that the programs respect. Okay, so then we talked about a particular cache design called a direct map cache. So for this, our first step was that we divide our memory and our storage in our cache into fixed size blocks. And in fact, not only fixed, but we always chose a power of two size. And by choosing a power of two size, when we looked at the lower, the least significant bits of the address, that always told us where in a block we were. So if we think if we have 2-byte blocks, you know, we have an even byte and an odd byte in every block. If we have 4-byte blocks, we have the byte that's 0 mod 4, 1 mod 4, 2 mod 4, 3 mod 4, and we can find that out by just looking at the lower bits. We don't actually need to do like a full remainder operation. And we took the blocks of memory and we assigned each one to a single cache block. So every block of memory had exactly one place we would put it in the cache. And we did this assignment kind of in order. So block 0 of memory went to cache block 0, block 1 went to cache block 1, and so on. Of course, there's more blocks of memory than blocks of cache because our cache is smaller and faster. So if we have S blocks in our cache, block S of memory went to block 0 because we didn't have block S of the cache. We heard it was 0, we ran out. And we just wrapped around like that. And the way this ends up looking, if we think about how the addresses work, is that if we look at the bits of the address just before the offset that place in the block they are, that tells us exactly what the index of the block in the cache is. That it's going to end up being equivalent to like taking our block number and dividing by the total number of blocks in the cache and taking the remainder. And again, we're going to use a power of 2 size, so this is possible, because we really don't want to be doing division in our memory accesses. We want to do just look at bits. And by using power of 2 sizes, that's all we'll be doing. Yes, you could make a cache which does division, but division's pretty slow compared to what we want the cache speed to be most of the time. So we had our scheme for how we placed our blocks of memory in our cache, and then we needed to decide exactly where we would put our data about where they came from. So we had some metadata we needed. So one thing we needed is we needed a valid bit. So we needed to know, hey, if I had a cache block, where exactly did it actually come from? If I had a cache block, was it actually taken from memory, or is it in that site yet? So that's what the valid bit is for. Then we had to know, if it came from memory, where did it come from? And for that, we had this tag bit here. Tag. And what we did for the tag is we said, oh, we used the bottom bits of the address to figure out where in the block it is. We used the next bits to figure out which block it was in, and the remaining bits we used for the tag. We could have put the full address in the tag, but we don't actually need the lower bits because we've already know what they are based on where in the cache we're looking. So we just kept the bits we didn't need. We didn't use yet. So we could have fit more information, but that's just going to be extra storage for the cache. And I'm sorry for being distracted because I need to fix up my slides. But while I'm doing that, questions on things we covered last time. Okay. So. Okay, I just didn't put the slides for the quiz in the slide PDF. Interesting. So, probably should talk about a few of the quiz questions. So if we go to our quiz, start with the first question while I'm waiting for, ready. So, our first question here, we're asking, we have this 7-stage processor and we have a prediction where the JLE is not taken. So what gets executed and what would happen on our single cycle processor is that we'd run this add, we run this JLE, and then we run this R remove queue. And that would be one cycle, two cycles, three cycles for running. In our pipeline processor, well, that's not how it works because each instruction, we have to go through all five stages. And what's going to happen is we're going to start running this JLE, and then to figure out what to do next, we're going to go to foo, and we're going to start fetching these XORs here. And we're going to keep doing that. And in fact, this is not a five-stage processor, this is a seven-stage processor. So we're going to do that for, we're going to fetch it, and if we think of what the JLE is doing, we're going to let the JLE get to its execute to stage before we actually evaluate the jump, which is, we know because it states so in the question. Now, we could have designed this processor maybe some other ways, but the design that was chosen is that we evaluate this in execute to, and therefore figure out what to fetch in the next cycle. So our jump is going to have to go to the execute to stage before we can figure out we have to run this R remove queue. And in the meanwhile, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be fetching all these XOR instructions. How many are we going to fetch? Well, when the jump is in decode 1, we're going to fetch the first one. The jump is in decode 2, we're going to fetch the second. When the jump is in execute 1, we're going to fetch the third. When the jump is in execute 2, we're going to fetch the fourth. And then, finally, we'll figure out that we need to fetch the R remove queue. That will hopefully I have the slides I meant to be showing. And of course I misaligned. And so this is the timeline I got that we had our decode 1, decode 2, decode execute 1, execute 2, and then our fetch in cycle 7 if we're counting 1 as the add queue. And in the meanwhile, what was happening is we were running these XORs. So questions about that? Yes?
So you wouldn't have to stall the condition code?
So the question is, you wouldn't have to stall the condition code register?
Yeah, which, I mean, you not have to stall and then wait to get the condition code from the
end? So the question tried to answer this by saying that the jumps execute twos, which will use the condition codes executed by the previous instructions execute two stage. So based on that assumption, there should be no need for stalling because the condition codes we want to use are in fact going to have been computed in execute two before. So if that wasn't true, yes, we might have to stall or something. Like if we said, oh, using condition codes that were computed by the time it was in execute one, like that would be a problem. But we don't have a problem based on that assumption. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question in this case, the condition codes aren't a true input at the execute stage. So I think the assumption in this case is that we can do the condition code evaluation in the execute two stage alone. We don't need to use the full split execute stage, presumably because it's a lot simpler than what we're doing in the full execute one plus two. Is why how that processor would work. Other questions? Okay. Now I have my actual slides I intended to show. Okay, then we have question two, which was the other point of confusion. So in this question, we told you we have a processor, like our five-stage processor, that has specific amounts of instructions running in a program we're interested in. And we said, on this processor, we have a different branch prediction strategy. And we told you that when we mispredict, we take two cycles. We also told you that when we have a load use hazard, we have that memory to execute dependency, we take an extra cycle. And that when we have a return, we take three extra cycles. And we also told you how many of those instructions there were. And we told you that there's no other instructions which have hazards that take time. So what we would say is that, normally, if we didn't have any hazard stuff, we take one cycle per instruction. So that's our base time for an instruction, and we're talking about throughput here. Because if I'm thinking of running all the instructions in a program, what I care about is how long, sort of the average time it seems to take to complete each instruction, not sort of beginning to end time, because that's not what me as a program runner actually cares about. And I just said, okay, what are my categories? So I have my conditional jump instructions, and I needed to figure out, you know, how many cycles they would take beyond the one base. So the ones where we predicted correctly, we take no extra cycles. We basically ignore them. And this turned out to be a majority of the conditional jumps. So it's only the 20% which are taken, but the target is greater, based on the strategy we said, or where the 10% where it's not taken and the target is less. Those were predicted incorrectly. So for those, we want to have two extra cycles. So what I said is 10% are conditional jumps, 20% of those are the taken target more, and similarly 10% are conditional jumps, and 10% of those are the taken target less. That's how I decided to add two cycles for each of those. So I said 10% times 20% is the number of the first category, 2%, and 10% times 10% is the number of the third category, the not taken target less. That was that 10 times 10. The taken target more was the 10 times 20. And I also had my memory to execute dependency, which was one cycle, and that I just added here to get my 1.16 cycles. So questions, how I figured that out? Yes? Question, this number of stages I have affect cycles per instruction? So as far as throughput goes, the way it affects it is that these numbers here might be different. Or I might have additional categories I wouldn't have. So like, for example, on a processor with the split execute stage, I'd have also like an execute 2 to execute 1 dependency would be another thing that would take extra cycles. So the extra stages, as far as throughput goes, we're going to have the increased cycles per instruction from having more hazard situations and more time per hazard situation. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. And now let's talk about, first, okay. Quiz questions 3 and 4, 4 and 5. 3 is probably the one we really need to go over. If I look at the scores, yeah. 4 and 5, I'm probably fine not. So for 3, is asking about what has better temporal locality, the elements of A or I. So if we think of the elements of A, like, yes, we're accessing the elements of A repeatedly, but the way our cache is going to work is we're not going to, like, put the whole array A in the cache. Like, and what we're accessing is not the whole array A. We're accessing parts of the array. And that's what we care about, the locality. So the question of do we have good temporal locality with the elements of A is, like, if I look at each thing we're accessing, are we accessing that exact thing again? No, that thing we're getting from memory. And the answer is mostly no. Sometimes yes, because we access them twice, and probably more than twice because we like read and write each time. So we access them like 4 times before going on. But if we compare that to I, we're accessing I a whole bunch of times, over and over again, tens of thousands of times, right in a row, quick succession. So I has excellent temporal locality. The elements of A, like A of 0, A of 1, they have good temporal locality in that, like, we do use them again, but not nearly as good as I, where we're, you know, accessing it all the time. And if we think of our cache, right, if I isn't kept in a register or kept in our cache, we're going to be really disappointed. If the elements of A aren't, we're going to be disappointed, but not nearly as disappointed. So questions on figured out that answer? Skip the, I think the others people did fairly well on. I have slides for them, but probably won't go over them unless there are questions on other things on the quiz. Yes? Question six. Okay. Sorry? Address 2C is in the cache. So for this question, first I figured out, I wanted to figure out how I divide up addresses for this cache. And looking at the cache that was shown, we saw that there were 4 bytes per block because we listed out 4-byte values. So we have 2 offset bits. And I can see from my cache that I have 4 rows, so 4 sets, which means I have 2 index bits. Also, I can see I've written out 2 bits for the index. So another hint. So the way we're going to divide up our addresses, so I'm going to look at the address I have, and the lower 2 bits are going to be my offset, and the next 2 bits are going to be my index, and the rest is going to be the tag. So in the case of 7, the index is 01, the tag is 11. That's a miss. The index is 01, the tag is zeros, because there's just leaving zeros I didn't write. And that's a miss, because if I look at index 01, the thing that's stored, there is something stored there because it is valid, but it's not tag zeros. And the one you were quite having a question about was? The what? The 2C, okay, not D, yes. So this one here. So this address here, which I hopefully converted correctly to C, yeah. So our offset is 00, our index is 11, and so that goes here, and our tag is still, like, I just didn't write all the leading zeros, so it's 010 if I'm writing all the leading zeros, and that was in the cache. And this process of looking up is very mechanical, which is good, because we want to implement this in hardware, and hopefully the hardware is not making any difficult decisions that need to be really fast. Other questions on the quiz? Yes. Can I go over number 4? Okay. So number 4 was about the spatial locality. Okay. So if we think of the machine code for the loop, we are accessing it over and over again, but spatial locality is about, if I see an access to this, what does that tell me about accesses to things nearby? And the biggest thing with code it tells me is that I'm going to access the thing after this soon. Right. And that sort of spatial locality is about those sorts of patterns, that if I see an access to this, what does it tell me about accessing something like next to it? And that sort of pattern. And I would say for the loop, the main thing we're going to have that spatial locality is going to be that, you know, if I see an access to this plus the add instruction here, I'm going to see an access soon to the multiply instruction. Like, that's the sort of spatial locality we have. And I would call, like, that the loop's repeated more of a temporal locality thing, but definitions of spatial locality are not precise. There are ways of defining it precisely, and they would differ on whether they'd say that this loop being repeated is also an example of spatial locality, which is why I accepted either more or about the same. As far as the CL, this likely in assembly is a whole bunch of instructions, right? And with the question, we said to assume it's about the same number, which I don't think is unreasonable, because putting strings together and calling, like, a function one time for each of the insertion operators. And those are going to be executed near each other, so they have good spatial locality in that sense. We're going to say we're calling a whole bunch of insertion operators, or we're, like, inlining the code for them, so, like, the code for that print is there. So I think probably it has good spatial locality because of that. So we just have a whole bunch of instructions that are going to be accessed in quick succession. I guess I could see the argument that, oh, there might be function calls there and there's not function calls in the other one, and maybe that's more spatial locality. Didn't think about that precisely, but we have a bunch of code that's going to be executed one after the other. That's sort of how machine code works. It has good spatial locality, and our cache can take advantage of that by making sure that when I load the code that handles this, I also load the code that handles this. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's on our quiz, and sorry for not having the slides on the quiz actually in the slide deck. Good work. Okay, so let's do some examples of how direct map cache works with accesses. So far we've looked at kind of looking things up in the cache. Let's sort of simulate what happens. So here I have a cache, and I want to simulate this list of accesses, which I've written in binary and hexadecimal. Hexadecimal is in parentheses. And if we want to simulate this, the first thing we need to do is need to figure out how is the cache going to divide up this address into our tag, index, and offset. So can someone get me started at figuring out any part of dividing up this address into tag, index, and offset? Yeah. Okay, so you say the offset's the least significant bit, and it's only 1 bit because we have 2 byte blocks. 2 is 2 to the 1 bytes. We just need to determine. We just need 1 bit to determine if it's the first or second byte. And then we can figure out the index is 2 bits. I can figure this out because there are 4, which is 2 to the 2 rows, or because I labeled the rows by their indexes and I needed 2 bits to do that. And everything else is going to be the tag. And we could also figure this out from our formulas. The textbook has, but those are just reflecting, oh, if I have 4 rows, that's, if I take log base 2 of that, that gives me the number of bits I need to represent all the indices. Yeah. And similar to what we've been thinking about here, that just how many bits do I need to represent each index into these blocks or this list of rows and so on. And so given that, we can mark off the parts of our addresses. And to simulate what this cache will do, I'm going to say, okay, we're going to start with our first address, this 0. And I'm going to say, okay, so let's look in our cache. The index is 0, so I'm going to look here. I'm going to see if there's something there. And there's not. It's valid a bit is 0. There's not something there. And so what's going to happen is we're going to call this a miss. And we're not just going to do nothing. We're not just going to say, sorry, it's not in the cache. We're going to get it, because remember, the cache gets the value, and it's going to forward, send it out to the processor, and we're going to put it in the cache. So in this case, I mark the first index as valid. I put in my tag from the address, and I also copy the values from memory. I'm representing them as sort of lookup in an array called mem, but these would be whatever values happen to be in memory at those addresses. And we're going to copy 2 addresses, even though the processor only asks for 1 byte, 2 bytes. In this case, the processor only asks for 1. And it happens that the processor, as is nest access, asks for byte 1, the other byte. So what we're going to do here is we're going to say, okay, let's look at index 0. This is index 0. It's valid, so I can check the tag. And I look at this tag and I say, yep, that is the same tag in the address I'm looking at. Therefore, it's going to be a hit, and we're going to send back to the processor the second byte of this block that it didn't actually read before, but in this case is a hit because we're taking advantage of spatial locality. So questions happened so far. Okay, so then we have an access to address 63. We look at how that divides up into bits. This goes into index 1. There's nothing in index 1, so this is going to be a miss. We're going to bring in 6.2 and 6.3. Why 6.2 and 6.3? Well, because we bring in the thing with offset 0 and the thing with offset 1. Right. So in this case, since this has offset 1, the thing I'm looking for is always stored in the second half of the block. Doesn't matter that you might prefer to put 6.3 and 6.4, but the cache doesn't allow that. It has to always be offset 0 to offset 1. That's just how we've divided up memory into blocks, so that blocks always start at an even address. So we brought that in. Then we have an access to 6-1. So in this case, this access is index 0, so we look at index 0. It's valid, but we actually need to check the tab. And we find out that that's going to be also a miss. Question before, yes? Can I explain why we did 6 on this previous access? Can I explain why did we bring in 6-2 and 6-3? So if we think of what goes in this set here, we're going to have the tag and the index and the offset, and our possible offsets are 0 and 1. We know our tag, based on the what we've written down, is going to be always 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, or we put in here. And our index is always going to be 0, 1. So the two addresses whose data we can store here are that tag, that plus that index plus 0, that tag plus that index plus 1. So those are the only two addresses we're allowed to store based on the setting for the tag and the index. And that happens to be 6-2 and 6-3. And because we have this scheme, we can't change our mind and say, gosh, we started with 6-3, wouldn't it be better to put in 6-4? Well, probably it would. But because of the way we've divided up our cache, we've decided in advance that 6-3 goes with 6-2, not with 6-4. Because 6-4 has a different index, so it goes in a different row. Does that answer your question? And I guess this is, I probably should emphasize because this is a common point of confusion. People really want to do something which would probably be better for spatial locality, but part of our cache is organized this way to make the lookups really simple. And make the lookups a lot less simple if we had to dynamically change where the blocks started. So caches don't do that. Other questions? Okay, so we were looking at this next access here. So here we have an access to index 0. So we look at index 0, it's valid. But we're not done yet. We have to check the tag. And here, the tag we're looking for is 01100. That is not the same thing that's in index 0. So this is a miss. The value is not there. And what we're going to do is we're going to bring in the block that came from. And this block starts with 6-0, or we start at that even number. So we're bringing in 6-0 and 6-1, replacing 0-0 and 0-1. And if we look ahead, it turns out that that was a bad idea. But that's not something we're going to take into account. We don't know what's going to happen, what the processor is going to ask for later on. We're just going to say, well, I assume temporal locality exists, therefore I assume you're more likely to access 6-1 again than access 0-1 again, or 0-0 again. Just because you've accessed it more recently, therefore the sort of assumption of temporal locality says you should need it, you're more likely to need it than those older things. In that case, this case, this is wrong, but in a typical program, that's right more often than not. So questions? So then we access address 6-2. So this is index 0-1. We look at 0-1. It's valid. We check the tag 0-1-1-0-0. 0-1-1-0-0. It matches. So that's going to be a hit. And we're going to send back that value from the data there. Then we access 0-0. And as mentioned before, we just got rid of this block. So we look at index 0, it's valid, we check the tag. The tag is not all zeros like in the address the processor's asking for, so that's going to be a miss. And we're going to replace that back with 0-0 and 0-1. We've just swapped it back. Old one. And then finally we have an access to address 6-4. So I look at the index, it's 1-0. 1-0 is not valid. So it's going to be a miss. I'm going to bring in the block containing 6.4, which is 6.4 and 6.5. So questions on how I evaluated this access pattern happened here. Okay, so in that case, let's do a different example. So here I've changed our blocks to 4 bytes. So what's that going to change about how we divide up the addresses? So previously it was 2 bytes, now it's 4. What's that going to change? Yes. So the last 2 bits, instead of 1 as before, will be the offset. So this will be our offset. And so this means that when we want to split one of these addresses to tag index and offset, our offset's the last 2 bits, our index is the next 2 bits, and everything else is the tag. So we end up with this tag index and offset, so our offset is just a little bigger this time. Everything else about how we split up the address is the same, because everything else about the cache was the same. So now, figure out which of these accesses are going to be hit. So we're starting off with initially everything, assume everything is invalid, so nothing's in the cache, so all the valid bits are 0. And then we run these accesses, which of them are going to be hits, which are going to be misses. Question, yes? Why do we know that the index is 2 bits? So there are 4 sets, and each of them needs to have a unique index. Who'd like some more time? So let's start with the first axis. Who thinks it's a hit, a miss? Okay, so the first one's probably the simplest one, because if we look at our cache, we can just ignore everything about the axis and say, well, there's nothing in the cache, it has to be a miss. So this is a miss. And when we have this miss, what's going to happen to the cache? What's going to happen to the cache as a result of this? Yeah? So index 00, the tag's going to be updated to all zeros. Anything else? So 03, and we got 03 because if we look at the maximum offset, that's 3. And there's one other thing, which is the valid bit's going to be updated to 1. Question? Yes? How many zeros would be in the tag? Oh, sorry, 3, 4 zeros, yes. It should be a copy of the number I have highlighted in green. Yes? How did I figure out it's 00 through 03? So if I think of our addresses, we have our tag is always going to be 000 based on what we have. The index is always going to be 00 based on this row. And the offsets are going to be anything from 00 to 11. 11 is 3, 00 is 0. And that gives me my range. So to figure out the range, I just say, what happens if the offset of zeros, offset of ones, and that's the range of values that can be stored in the block. Okay, so our second axis, who thinks it's a hit, thinks it's a miss, and it indeed is a hit, goes to what we just accessed. How about our third axis, who thinks it's a hit, thinks it's a miss? Okay, so it's a miss. And the way you might tell this is you might say, well, I looked here, it only has 0 through 3, that's not 0 through 3. But the way the processor is going to check is it's going to say, this is index 0, therefore I look here, I check if it's valid, I check the tag doesn't match here, and that's why it detects it's a miss. So what's going to happen as a result of this miss? Every time we have a miss, something happens to the cache. Yes? You change the tag to 0110, okay. Anything else? Okay, and we also store different values. We don't want to correspond to the tag, which we hex 60 through 63. I'll write a leading X, indicate that that's hex and not decimal. So questions about that update? Okay, so how about our access to, our next access to 6.1? Who thinks it's a hit? thinks it's a miss. No clue. Okay. So it's hit. So one way we could figure out is a hit, so we could look at, I just wrote 6.0 through 6.3, and it's in that range. What the processor is going to do is going to say, we check index 0, I check the tag, and the tag matches, therefore it's stored there, and I can use the offset to figure out where exactly in the block it is. And we're going to find out the same thing for 6.2. 6.2 is also a hit. Then the access to 0.0, that's going to be a miss. And the way the processor is going to figure this out, it's going to say, okay, at index 0, there is something, but the tag doesn't match. So what's going to happen as a result of that miss? Anyone? So our access to 0.0, near the end of this pattern, yes. Yeah. So to go back to the configuration we had after our first access, yes. So the way that's going to look is we'll have our tag will become 0.0 again. Instead of having 6.0 through 6.3, we'll have 0.0 through 0.3 again. And then we have an access to 6.4. So this is going to be another miss. And how is this going to update the cache? Yes?
How does something update
it? So 0.1 index? The tag? Which tag? This tag here?
Yeah, for index 1, it's going
for index 1.
Oh, sorry, we have one last
access. Yeah, so this last access is index 1. Which you said, but
sorry.
Which is not the same tag we've been looking at. Sorry, at index what?
At index 0, it's going to be 0.0.
Okay, it's going to be 0.0.0, but what's going to change?
At index 0.1, it's going to be 0.1.
Okay. And what's going to be?
Valid's going to be 1.0.
Okay, and valid's going to be 1, and we're also going to load the value from this location, so it's going to be 6.4 through 6.7. Okay, so questions, how I figured that out? Okay, so we've seen how direct map caches sort of work mechanically for reads. Talked about writes yet, we're going to do that probably not even this time. But you may have noticed something that's maybe kind of annoying, that we have a bunch of accesses where we kind of throw away a whole bunch of stuff that probably we should keep in the cache, and we often do it despite having a lot of extra space in the cache. So we saw that here, where the way the access pattern worked out, we didn't use all our sets, and we still had things being replaced. We saw it less extremely here, where I have this second access to 0.0, replace this 6.1 stuff that maybe is more important. And it does turn out with realistic access patterns that this can be a problem. And the solution that we typically use to extend direct map caches for this is we add what's called associativity. So rather than just having one place to store values for each possible index, I say I'm going to have a couple places, or at least 2, 3, 4, some more than one place to store values for each index, so I won't have to do that. So in the cases where, you know, we have two different things that happen to have the same index, then I can keep both of them. You have more than two, well, we're out of luck, but this should hopefully keep coincidences from making us evict things from our cache that are still in use. That if we just have some bad luck and they happen to have the same index bits, we can still keep an extra copy, but we still are taking advantage of keeping our cache simple. We don't have many places for values to go, we just have, in this case, too. So to avoid these sort of conflicts, like this example of sort of 6.1 interfering with 0.0 and 0.1, I can have two places to put values. So in this case, we'll still call each of the rows sets. We'll call the columns ways of our cache. the term we'll use. And you can think of that each way of this cache is kind of its own direct map cache, and we're just like you basically putting two direct map caches together. But of course, we're going to have to do some, you know, decisions when deciding which one do we put a new value in. And as far as how we divide up addresses, sort of the same principles apply as before. So if I want to figure out how many index bits there are, I still look at the number of rows. If I want to figure out how many offset bits there are, I still look at the size of my blocks. It just happened. So dividing up the address is basically the same logic we saw before. As far as what happens in accesses, so let's look at sort of this access pattern. So first of all, let's look at how the addresses are divided up. Because I have four blocks here, but because I've divided them into just two sets instead of four, I now have only one index bit instead of two. And that means my tag got bigger. If we look at our first access here, the index is 0. The offset is also 0. I'm going to store that in this cache here, just like before. Then I have my access to 1. That's going to look at index 0. And I'm going to check both of the ways here. And I'm going to say, OK, could it be here? And I'm going to find out, yes, so I'm done. That's going to be a hit. I access address 63. This is going to be index 1. It's not in the cache yet, so I'm going to add it to my cache. And it's going to be a miss. And again, I'm adding the whole block. The block starts at address 6.2. As it happens, all our blocks start at an even address. So it's 6.2 and 6.3. So questions on what I've done so far? So far, this looks like a direct map cache because we haven't used our second way yet. Yes?
Way 1, that index is not valid. Is it pointless to even time in way 2?
So question, if way 1, that index is not valid, does it point to...
Is it pointless to even look at way 2?
Question, if way 1 is not valid, is it pointless to look at way 2? So in the way we've learned to fill cache, yes. But in a real processor, there will be reasons to make things invalid other than the first access to them. So it would not be. Other questions? OK, so then we have an address to 6.1. So here, I'm going to look at index 0. And I have two possibilities. So my first one, well, this is valid, so I'm going to check the tag. The tag does not match, so it's not there. And check the other one. It's not valid. It's not there. So this is a miss. But when I'm going to place 6.0 and 6.1, I'm not going to just place our first way here. I'm going to use the second one because, well, that's the point of having a second one. If I didn't do that, it'd be kind of silly to have this whole second block in that set. We're going to have some free place to put this. And now we're storing these two things which happen to share an index together. And that's hopefully going to give us better efficiency from our cache. So yes, our cache might be slower because we're checking more tags. But hopefully we have a higher hit rate. More often, we find things in the cache because we're able to better take advantage of locality. Because when we have this coincidence, we don't not take advantage of temporal locality anymore. So then I access 6.2. That's a hit. So that's index 1. And it's in our first way. So that's a hit. Then I access 0.0. And this time, that's a hit. We solved the problem that we had before of, oh, it got evicted for 6.0 and 6.1. Not true anymore. This time, because we had a second place to put things for index 0, we're fine. Okay. And finally, I have an access to 6.4. So let's think about how we do this. So this is index 0. So I go to index 0. I check the first way. Is it? It's valid. So I'm going to compare the tags. The tag is all zeros versus 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1. Doesn't match. So I check the second way. Tag is 1. Valid is 1, so we're going to check the tag. The tag is 011000. That's not the same as this thing, which ends with a 1. So it's a miss. And there's a question we're going to get to later, which is I need to figure out where do I put this new thing, this block 6465. There are two places I could put it, and it's not clear which one I should choose. And we'll talk about strategies for doing that later. There's actually multiple choices that real processors make. But we're gonna need to put it somewhere because, you know, our assumption is that 6.4 is more likely to be accessed than one of those things soon because of temporal locality. So questions? Sorry, yes. In question, don't we end up with the same amount of hits as when we had larger byte size for our blocks? That may be the case, but if we think of how much storage those two caches need, that here I have 2, 4, 6, 8 bytes plus, you know, about 1, 2, 3, 4 bytes of extra metadata in our. In this cache here, I have 4, 8, 12, 16 plus about, you know, 1, 2, plus 2, 3 extra bytes. So I actually have a lot more storage, even though it's maybe not obvious from the diagrams in the 4-byte block cache. So it's not surprising that the 4-byte block cache with that much more storage has a higher hit rate, but because it has a lot more storage, it might also be slower. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about these caches. So this more general version of a cache, so here I'm showing sort of how this might look. Cache, we have our begin, our tag, index, and offset. And the way this is going to work in the hardware, we'll use the index to retrieve the whole row of the cache. So there will be the typical way the memories that store caches work is that we have some way of taking a row number and retrieving all the data in that row. So we'll get the data in that row, and we'll check, typically in parallel, both of the tags and the valid bits and see which one matches. In this case, you know, I'm just using a mux to figure that out, but if we could have 3 or 4 ways, in which case that would be a little more complicated. But it should be the case that exactly one of these, we have the tag matching and the valid bit being 1, because hopefully we're not storing 2 copies of the same block in the cache. So either exactly one of these will match or none of them will match. None of them match, that's a miss. If one of them match, it's gonna be a hit. And we'll retrieve the data once we figure out the correct block of our choices, just as before. Okay. And when we have this sort of lookup, we have sort of 3 possibilities for the outcome of the lookup. So one possibility is that we'll look up a set and none of the blocks are valid. So that we saw that case when we started out, our cache was empty, none of the blocks were valid in the set, in which case it's a miss. It's also possible that some of the blocks are valid, but we check the tags and none of the tags match. That's probably going to be the most common case for a miss in practice. And we have what is hopefully the most common case in practice, which is exactly one of them is valid and matches the tag, but that's it. And some terminology here. So we had direct map caches, and we can kind of think of this scheme I showed you here, well, it's just a generalization of direct map caches. And the general name for this is E-way set associative, where E would be the number of blocks we have. So the example I showed you was 2 ways. We can have 3, 4, whatever number we want. And you can think of direct mapped is sort of the same thing as 1-way set associative. That's what a direct map cache is. It's just the 1-way version of this. We could also take this to the extreme and have the number of ways be equal to the number of blocks total in the cache, in which case we'll just have one sense. And this is called a fully associative cache. So this fully associative cache, how many index bits will have? Someone tell me how many index bits, if we have everything's in one set, we have one big wide set, just one row, how many index bits do we have? Is it one? So if we have one index bit, we have an index zero row and an index one row. So it's zero, yeah. And this is the most common point of confusion, which is why I bring it up. People really wanted to have at least one index bit. We can, in fact, have zero in the generic case. We can have zero index bits, and that's what a fully associative cache will have. So this means the address will be divided into offset and tag. And the way a fully associative cache works is, since we only have one set to check, we're going to check all the tags in that set and the values. So the fully associative cache is sort of the extreme opposite direct map. So with direct map, every block can go to exactly one place in the cache. With a two-way set associative, every block can go to two places in the cache. Three-way, three places. With a fully associative, every block can go to every place in the cache. Block of memory, every place in the cache. Some questions on this terminology? And as I said, our textbook had these formulas. So here's a version of the formulas that I flashed up earlier. Again, it's the same logic we saw before, that if I have, you know, four rows, that means there's two bits to determine which row I'm in. Or if I have eight rows, there's three bits to determine it. These formulas are just mostly saying, you know, if I have a particular number of rows, so that determines how many bits I need to index them. If I have a particular number of bytes in a block, I need to know how many bits I need to determine which block it is. That's why our block size is 2 to the number of bits we need to determine which byte in a block we are using. And the only difference from what you've seen before is that we also have this variable e for the number of ways. And our cache size, remember from before, doesn't include metadata, so our cache size now, if we're taking into account having multiple ways, is the number of bytes per block times the number of sets times the number of blocks per set, which now is not going to be one like our direct map cache, but could vary. Okay, so let's do a little exercise with some more realistic caches. So most sort of real processor caches are the set associative type. So for example, on my desktop, there are more than three caches, but we'll talk about three of them. So I have a level one data cache, and that is 32 kilobytes, has 8 blocks per set. So it's an 8-way cache, so not just 2, but 8 wide blocks, and it has 64 byte blocks. My level two cache, which is shared between Instratas and Instruction, is 256 kilobytes, has 4 ways, and 64 blocks. And there's a level 3 cache, which is 8 megabytes, and has 16 ways, and 64 blocks. And my question is, how do we divide up this address, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, for all these caches? And some notes on how I write numbers of bytes here. By 32 kilobytes, I mean a power of 2. I never mean a power of 10. And same thing for megabytes. So 32 kilobytes, I mean 32 times 2 to the 10 bytes, and 256 is going to be 256 times 2 to the 10, and 8 meg is going to be 8 times 2 to the 20 bytes. So I'm always going to use MB and KB to represent a power of 2 in this class, rather than a power of 10. So 2 to the 10 for kilobytes for KB, 2 to the 20 for MB. And it better be the case for caches, because we learned everything needs to be a power of 2 for us to divide things evenly into bits, or else it won't work. So I have the formulas if you want to work that way, but we can kind of reason about from the same way we did from the diagrams. We can think of what does the picture look like for these caches as far as what's the block, how many what the rows look like. So. Okay, could I have a volunteer tell me what a good first step would be for solving these? Yes? Okay, use the block size and do what with it? So 64 bytes, you want to convert to bits. So, okay, so I like the idea of finding the log 2, because we want to figure out how many bits do we need to identify which block. I don't think we don't need to convert 64 bytes into bits, and presuming we can only access one byte at a time. So if we could access individual bits, yes, we need to worry about that, but that's not, my desktop's not that nice. I have to address bytes, can't have a pointer to a bit. So in this case, we have 2 to the 64 bytes. That's 2 to the 6 byte blocks, which means we need 6 bits to find a byte within a block. Block, which means we have 6 offset bits. So this is 6, and it's 6 for all the caches because they all have the same block size, which isn't a coincidence. It's a lot simpler to send a fixed size between each of the caches. So the processor is designed that way. So we have 6 bits. So we know the bottom 6 bits of this address is the offset for all the caches. And we can figure out what those bottom 6 bits are by saying, oh, 7 is 0, 1, 1, 1, and 6 is 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. 0 and the bottom 6 bits are there for this 10011. So that's our offset for every single hash. So questions on how I figured that out? So we have all the offsets. So now we just need the indexes and the text. So what would be a useful thing to figure out to find one of the indexes? Yeah. The number of sets. So the number of sets probably is something we could try to compute. And we aren't given that here, but we're given some related information. So we're given, start with our L1 data cache. So we're given 32 kilobytes. So what does that represent? That's the amount of, that's our cache size. And our cache size, when we say cache size, we always just mean the amount of data. We aren't including any of the tag bits and the val bits. Yes, they take up space. When I say I have a 32 kilobyte cache, I mean I have 32 kilobytes of data. I'm not talking anything about the extra stuff I need to store alongside that data to figure out like where it came from. So what can I do with that information? Yeah.
Divide by the block size and the number of ways.
So divide by the block size and the number of ways. Because okay. So you're saying 32 kilobytes, first I'm going to figure out how many blocks there are. So divide by the block size. Then I want to figure out how many sets there are, so I divide by the number of ways, which is the number of blocks per set. That's going to give me the number of sets. Yeah. So that's exactly what I do. And when we do this for our first cache, so this is, you can derive this from the formulas, or we have just the logic of what the units are. That we have 32 kilobytes divided by the number of the block size times the number of ways. This gives us the number of sets. We get 64. So we have 64 sets. So what do we do with that information? So this means we have 64 rows in this cache. Log two of that, so we just need to know, I'm going to number these rows starting with all zeros, and what's going to have the end. I want to know how many bits I need to do that. So log base two is going to tell me that. I find out I need 6 bits, just like with our Hall set, it turns out. So questions about figuring that out? So here I have the logic with their formulas, but the formulas should reflect sort of what our pictures of the cache were showing. So I did that for the L1. We can repeat this process for the L2 and the L3. And we just have different sizes. And the tag bits is always what's left over. So then for dividing up the address, what I can do is I can say, I can write out my address in binary, and I can just say, okay, my bottom 6 bits are the offset. And then for the L1, the next 6 bits are the index, everything else is the tag. And I can do something similar for the L2 and the L3. Some questions on this exercise? Okay, so next time we'll talk about two big things about how set-associative cache works that we kind of skipped over. One is replacement policies. What do we do when a set is full? Like, which way do we use? And another is, how do we deal with writes? Because we only talked about reads so far, but obviously, if we can't write things to memory, it's not very useful.